Welcome back to the Lion Podcast. My name is Aaron Alexander. This is a place that we bring together the world's leading experts in all things health and wellness to help you optimize your mind, body, and movement. This conversation is with David Sutcliffe. I discovered David in a viral interview that went out between him and Andrew Tate, and I was very interested in unpacking and discussing some of the details behind the scenes of the interview, as well as some of the lessons from the interview and just some interesting things in relation to the mind of Andrew Tate and all of the different controversies and such going on, and also going into a lot around relationships, a lot around effective communication, getting into in touch with deeper access to oneself and how to do that. So this conversation, I think, is incredibly valuable. I'm really grateful for David taking the time to get to communicate and share some of the lessons and wisdom that he has gathered over the years. Thank you guys for subscribing so you get each week's episodes. I would also recommend jumping over to the Align Podcast YouTube page to see the video version of these episodes, as well as clips and instructional content. We just had the Teal Swan episodes, got something like 120 plus views and 1500 comments, and people just really went off on that. So it's really beautiful to get to see commentary and just get to communicate with you guys over there. All right, that is it. That is all. Thank you once again for subscribing anywhere you listen to this. Thank you for leaving us reviews. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for joining you. Let's get to it with the great and powerful David Sutcliffe. You say your last name Sutcliffe?
Sutcliffe.
Yeah. Sutcliffe.
You got it. You said it right. It's hard. It's two hard consonants.
It's an edgy name. It's like Sutcliffe. I like having this like very masculine Cliff at the end of your last name.
There's three famous Sutcliffes. Peter Sutcliffe, who was the fifth Beatle.
Okay.
Somebody, Sutcliffe, who was a Yorkshire Ripper, famous killer back somewhere in the UK.
Okay. Yorkshire Ripper sounds like some type of dog.
Yeah.
Is that a gang?
Yorkshire, I think, is a city in the UK.
I see.
So
he was a Ripper.
He was a Ripper. He was a killer. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then, oh no, Stu Sutcliffe was the fifth Beatle. Peter Sutcliffe was the killer. Rick Sutcliffe was the Chicago Cubs pitcher.
Oh, shit.
Who won the Cy Young in 86. And then, of course, me, David Sutcliffe. So there's four of us, because I'm a little bit famous.
Oh, you're on the come up. I discovered you through the Tate interview. Andrew Tate versus psychologist. I love that it's verse as well. I imagine that's their languaging.
No, that was mine.
Oh, good.
Yeah, he gave me a lot of freedom in terms of how I wanted to present it.
Oh, cool.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. How did that come about?
Well, I've done two interviews with him. I did an interview with him about 4 years ago during COVID. I had just started my podcast, and the idea was to do psychologically oriented interviews with people. And this was before he really blew up. He was a little bit known and famous and infamous.
Yeah.
And I responded to a tweet that he sent out saying, I'm open to interviews and podcasts. And I saw it like 11 seconds after he tweeted it.
Yeah.
So I messaged him immediately. We had some mutuals. And so I guess that's why he trusted me. But I said, hey, man, I'm a psychotherapist. Although I'm not technically a psychotherapist. I'm a quantigenetics practitioner. So I'm not allowed to call myself a psychotherapist. But that's essentially what I do.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, why don't we do an interview and I'll psychoanalyze you? And he was like, great, sounds like fun. So that interview was interesting. It was a lot of him talking.
Mm-hmm.
But it went, I don't know if it went viral, but it became very popular among his fans. And a lot of people were like, that's the best interview. And then he messaged me 3 months later and said, I finally watched the interview. That's the best interview anyone's ever done with me. Mm. Which was flattering and surprising, because I thought it was good, but I didn't do much.
Yeah.
And then he contacted me just before he got canceled, right when he was blowing up, and he said, I want to do another interview with you. Mm. I was like, great. Mm. And then he got canceled, so he was disappeared off social media. We were just in the process of setting it up, and then I didn't hear from him, and then he went to jail. And then he got out of jail. And he was on house arrest. And then I reached out to him. I said, how about that interview? And he said, well, if you want to come to Romania. And I said, I do.
Yeah.
And so I did. And that was that.
He's very intriguing to me. Like, in listening to the interview, it was really nice. You brought out a side that was very, like, childlike from him. It's underneath. There's, like, the gilding on top. you know, of like the warrior and the, you know, UFC champ guy, not that he's in the UFC, but like fighter, Genghis Khan, you know,
yeah.
I will only win, I am a competitor, you know, and I'm just living in this kind of like the palace of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's like fortress that he's created.
Mm-hmm.
But you could hear, or I could hear, I think you could because you called it out as well, there's like this childlike energy undercurrent underneath that.
Yeah.
And this like playfulness.
Yes.
As well. Like he knows it's a game.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not willing to show his hand beneath the game. It's the way that it feels. Like it feels like underneath that, like he knows there's a deeper, more vulnerable part. Is the way that it felt to me. I could be misspeaking.
Yeah, he knows some things. he doesn't know everything that's underneath.
Yeah, of course not.
Yeah, but yes, I think that's accurate. He's definitely playing a game, and he knows he's playing a game.
He knows he's playing a game.
He's very, very smart.
Yeah.
And he knows that he's smart. He's very capable. I mean, he can outsmart most people. He's figured out the game of making money and fame, and he did that very, very easily. I don't know exactly what he's up to. I mean, I asked him about that. Like, what's his higher purpose here beyond just, you know, winning?
Mm-hmm.
I think he does have a higher purpose. I think he's still trying to figure that out.
Yeah.
Because when you have that much talent, when God has given you all those gifts, it's like, I think there's, you know, there's something you want to do with it.
Yeah.
And, but I found him, yeah, exactly what you said. I found him like really playful. The fact that he agreed to the interview, that he asked for it
right
after the first one, I thought was interesting. I think in part because some of the qualities that he has, I also have. Like I relate to him.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up an athlete, and in the Reichian model, I have what they call a psychopathic defense, which is what he has.
What does that mean?
People might call it it's kind of narcissism, but what its intention is to control. So the psychopathic defense wants to control. Mm. Control is how they achieve safety. And they're very good at control. They're very smart. They're very adapted in the mind. They rationalize, very powerful, very aggressive. Those are all the characteristics of the psychopathic defense. And he has that. I have that. It's very common. Most actors or people in the public eye, that's their defense to varying degrees.
Yeah.
And so I'm not scared of that. And I know that. So it's easy for me to see what's going on underneath. And I think that he appreciated that I saw past his facade.
I think he likes to be seen past.
We all want to be seen. Yeah, we all want to be known. We all want to be seen.
Most people probably don't have the, I don't know, spaciousness or depth within themselves, perhaps, or willingness to see beyond the words.
Yeah.
And so when you're with someone that's able to be present with and hear the words, but also listen and feel deeper beyond them,
mm-hmm.
there's probably something very satiating, which is probably why he was attracted to having you back.
Well, I yeah.
Even if he wasn't willing to admit to any of those deeper undercurrents, it still probably feels good.
Yeah, he did it. I mean, he admits to them by accepting the interview.
Yeah.
He's admitting on some level that he knows there's things about himself that he doesn't know. He just wants to play the game, and he wanted to test me. And I think that he doesn't face many people that can actually meet him in that way. Like, not that I can outsmart him, but there's things that I know that he doesn't know. There's experiences mm-hmm. that I've had that he hasn't had.
Yeah.
And when he starts talking, and he starts coming full barrel with his point of view, it's overwhelming. Like, it's hypnotic.
Yeah.
And there was a point in the interview where he came at me with that energy, and I could feel myself, like, pulled into his spell, like, yeah, pulled right. into his world. And it was a moment, because I couldn't keep up with that, and I knew I wasn't going to win. And yeah. so I just noticed what I was feeling in the moment, which was controlled. And then I thought about what he's actually doing from the defense, and I called him on it. And in the second I called him on it, he just started laughing.
Mm.
And that's when I knew that we were—
You have rapport.
Yeah, that we have rapport. Like, he wants to be called on. We want to be called on our shit.
Yeah.
Because I'm demonstrating that I can see the game. Now, the main thing is make fun of him.
Right.
You know, like, I appreciate it. Like, so, I mean, that's a big part of, I mean, whether it's interviews, you're doing therapy. If you want to gain trust with somebody, you have to see them and appreciate them and not make them bad or wrong and just be with them there. And so that's all I was really trying to do in that interview. Not from my own manipulation, because I'm genuinely curious about the guy and I find him fascinating. And I appreciate him and I appreciate all that he's doing in the world. Yeah. You know, I know he's got a shadow, we all do, but the amount of vulnerability that it takes to put yourself out there like that and to say all the things that you think, knowing that, you know, all kinds of negative transference is going to come back at you and be able to hold that.
It's very vulnerable.
That's incredible to me. When people say he's not vulnerable, I'm like, maybe not in the way that you see vulnerability, but putting yourself out there the way he is, that's fucking vulnerable. He's letting the whole world see him, blind spots and all. I think that takes a lot of courage.
Yeah. And the way that he communicates, and I won't make this whole conversation just about Tate. It was just, I found that conversation to be one of the most interesting interviews that I've listened to, because Tate's so interesting. And it just, the fact that he is kind of like, it feels almost like he's drank his own Kool-Aid of the symbol that he represents in a way.
Yeah.
And he's like the embodiment of this archetype. And then there's also the boy.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to see someone hold that archetype and that symbol so, like, you know, well.
Yeah.
And then also there's the humanity underneath that.
Yeah.
That he kind of hints at and allows little sprinkles of it to come out. But it's just, I just find it, like, endlessly fascinating to be able to listen to someone as fluent and adept with, you know, consciousness and the mind and those undercurrents as you, to be able to like, hold that and navigate that together.
Yeah.
So those are the reasons I'm interested in talking about it.
Well, it's an interesting interview. When I saw it, I was fascinated by it. You know, I found it very almost like a, like less like an interview. It was because it had a story to it. There was an arc. There was an unraveling, and I had that thought in my mind when we started the interview. It's like, we have to tell a story here, or otherwise it's not going to be interesting. Like there has to be an arc. Like, I have to take him somewhere, and I think that happened, and in part because we're both performers, like, and you know, I used to be an actor, and so I inherently understand the idea of story, and I think he does too. And he gave me a lot of openings in that interview, I think because he knew he had to, or the interview wasn't going to be interesting.
Right.
There's something that happens when you're recording an interview, when you're putting it out on camera, and because there was a lot of anticipation about this, at least between the two of us, because we've been talking about it for so long, and because this was the second one. And because of his situation, obviously I was extremely nervous about it. The first time I wasn't nervous at all, because I was like, whatever, we're on Zoom. Okay, some crazy guy, like, you know, let's talk about it. But at this point, I'm interviewing one of the most famous people on the planet.
Yeah.
And I know there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on me.
Yeah.
So I was a little nervous about that. But yeah, it was just this idea of like, we have to tell a story. So I think what happened when I watched it back, I was like, oh, we created something together.
That's
like,
really beautiful.
And that there was a, because again, when, from my experience as an actor, when you find a scene partner that you can really groove with, you can let go, and you know you're going to make something interesting together. And I had that experience in that interview. There was a lot of rapport. And again, kudos to him, man. Like, he really trusted me. You know, he gave over an aspect of himself to my authority. Like, at the end, when I kind of like, hey, man, like, no, like, stop fucking thinking and just be here with me for a second. Like, he did it. And I saw it.
Yeah, right.
Like, I saw him come all the way present and feel something.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fucking awesome. Like, if that was a first therapy session, I would have considered it a huge success.
Yeah. Well, he, I think, is a representation of something that I experience as a guy. Like a fear, and I don't want to project anything onto him, so I'll just speak for myself. But if my projection is accurate, it seems like there's a fear of feeling those deeper, more vulnerable interior parts of oneself, because that's where a person opens themselves to be healed and also be hurt. So if you allow yourself to open up into those places, it's the greatest reward, but it's also the greatest, you know, suffering on the other side of that is possible.
Yeah.
Maybe not long-term suffering, but
pain. Acute, I don't know if it's suffering. It's definitely pain.
Short-term acute pain.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that is something that modern humans, I'd imagine, but particularly men who are entrenched in a culture where it's celebrated to be stoic. It's celebrated to be kind of this symbol that Andrew Tate represents. That's, I think, what a lot of men are striving towards, hence why, you know, he's the most Googled guy on the internet.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting how that, I think simultaneously, the positive quality he represents, they exist, and I think they're actually quite abundant. And then also the shadow sides of that as well. And perhaps, not speaking for Tate, just speaking for myself, fear of leaning into those deeper, more interior parts because of the potential pain that can come if you open yourself up to those parts.
Yeah.
Is that something that, how does a person, what do you think about that?
I think that's exactly right. I think it's true for women as well. I mean,
yeah,
I've been doing this for a long time, and there's this idea that women are more in touch with their emotions than men are. That is not true. Women talk about their emotions more, and they're able to cry, but I don't, in my experience, I don't see evidence of that. Men and women process emotions and express emotions in different ways, and I think one of the things that has happened, and you're seeing a lot of talk about this and criticism, is that most of the psychotherapeutic community it's dominated by women. 80% of psychotherapists are women. So there is a feminine bias to it. And I think that's also part of the problem why you see a lot of pushback from men against psychotherapy or against this idea of, like, you know, get in touch with your feelings. And I had that experience in my training. That said, that's the whole game that I'm playing with people when I'm working with them, is I'm trying to lead them to the place inside themselves that they're afraid to feel.
Yep.
Because if there's something inside yourself that you're afraid to feel, you're avoiding, and you're going to avoid anything in your life that might bring up those feelings unconsciously. And so from that place, you are not free.
Yeah.
And you develop a construct in your mind to rationalize all of it. And so you're in some kind of delusion and some kind of lie. So for me, it's like going into the feelings is the pathway to freedom. It's scary. And I think there's a lot of images about what that means. It doesn't mean becoming a slave to your feelings or being emotional all the time.
Yeah.
It means creating spaces, I think, whether it's with a group of men or in psychotherapy, to allow yourself to feel the pain. And it's really mostly the boys' pain. Like, we were all little at what Tate was, a little boy, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. And when you hear stories about his father and how harsh he was, that must have been terrifying. I mean, he admitted it, right? It was terrifying for him. Well, what did he do with all of that fear? Like, where does it live in his body? Like, he transmuted it into something, which is great. And I think we all do have a version of that, but we forget how scared childhood is, how we're little. We're just little. I mean, go look at a 5-year-old boy and you see how fucking vulnerable they are and how you can say one little thing to them and you could destroy them.
Yeah.
And then you think about how hard it is to raise children.
If they respect you.
Yeah, if they respect you. But how hard it is to raise children and all the issues that—
if they're bound to you, if they have connection with you. If you're just somebody off the street, you also could, but—
You could, but if you're a teacher or a coach or— You know, children are very, very sensitive, and they're absorbing things all the time. And all children have, I think we all have trauma. We've all had traumatic experiences, large and small. And that's true for men. And I think that's what you're seeing in the culture, like this conversation around men. I think it gets distorted, and I don't necessarily like the frame that's put around it, like, you know, toxic masculinity and all of that.
Yeah.
But this idea that it would be good for men to feel their feelings, I think is correct. And I think there's an image around that is incorrect, which is you can be a badass motherfucker and stoic and provide and protect all of these, you know, masculine virtues that we think about and men feel pride about and women actually want. You can have it all And that's, you know, that's what, when I'm working with men, that's what I'm trying to convince them of, that you're not giving up. You don't have to give up anything just to be willing to feel and to be vulnerable. In fact, like, being vulnerable, I think is really, it takes a lot of strength to say, I'm afraid or I'm hurt. And I was really hurt by what happened, you know? Whether you let, if you let that pain or that hurt like take you over and you act out from there, well, no, that's not great. But to be able to name it and contain those feelings without shame, I think is a kind of mastery.
Yeah. And then you can also take the leveraging the I'm hurt or the, you know, self-victimization as a tool to be able to navigate the world with.
Yes.
To be able to guilt people or cause people, you know, to actually give you power. You know, and so that's, it's like, is a person, this is kind of Tate's perspective based off of, I'd imagine, feeling manipulated by someone at some point in his past that was meaningful. He suggested in the interview that he has a distrust of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so if someone cries, he doesn't have empathy for someone crying. He doesn't have like, I don't know if that's totally true. He doesn't have empathy, but he's like, I won't be able, if someone can rationally, logically, you know, pragmatically break down how they're feeling and what's happening,
yeah,
I'm able to address that.
Yeah.
But if someone comes to me with, you know, they're emotional and they're crying and all of that,
like, yeah,
I can't trust that.
Well, I said that in the interview, that's a projection.
Yeah.
You know, that's your own projection. That's you shame and judge your own feelings. So you shame and judge them in others.
Right.
Especially with a woman. Women are going to cry.
Like,
you know, they're going to come to you with your problems. They're going to be irrational at times. I'm not saying women are irrational,
yeah,
but in that state they can be. And your job is to be with them there.
Yeah.
And hold space for them there.
His belief is all the emotions are manipulation.
Yeah. Yeah.
The reality, I would suggest, a percentage of emotions can be a manipulation.
And the person experiencing, you can use them to manipulate.
Yeah, and the person could be manipulating themselves.
That's right.
And expressing out just through, like, trickling back from that or down from that. It's like they're manipulating others because they're actually, in fact, manipulating themselves.
Yeah,
within that's 100%. Within their web of emotion.
Well, if you're making yourself a victim, you are using your emotions to manipulate either yourself or others. It's really that simple. Like, you can feel your feelings without making yourself a victim. You just take responsibility for them. Like, and that's really the end game. Okay. Like, my dad wasn't around. My mom was a little crazy at times, you know, she was young and overwhelmed, and I got hurt, and I can spend my life blaming them for the pain and suffering that they caused me. But that time has come and gone. I mean, that pain now belongs to me. And so I have to take responsibility for it. They did their best. I sincerely believe that. So it's really about that. Like, I have pain. Like, I'm angry. And the more you can take responsibility for that, the less reactive you're going to be, and the less that you're going to use your emotions to, I mean, it's interesting that you said that, to manipulate yourself or to manipulate others, you know. But also, most people are afraid to feel. They're terrified to feel. I mean, the only thing you're actually afraid of is feeling. If you're not afraid to feel, what are you actually afraid of? I understand, okay, a lion jumps out and wants to kill you, but just emotionally in life, like, I think most people are afraid a lot of the time, and just because life is scary. We're afraid that we're not going to get what we want. We're afraid that people are going to judge us. We're afraid that we're going to be excluded. We're afraid that we're going to be alone. We're afraid that we're not going to be able to be loved. And I think that is, like, underneath a lot of what's going on in the world. And so that's a very hard thing to acknowledge and admit. But most people, because of their childhood, have some part of themselves that they believe is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because we all had aspects of ourselves that were either not seen or ignored or judged or shamed or made bad or wrong. And so because we have a priority to stay connected in favor with our caregivers, that's our best survival strategy, we separate from those parts of ourselves and we make them bad and wrong. And then that's a secret that we walk around with. It's all in the unconscious. So most people are walking around believing that there's some part of them that is bad. and then they're compensating for it. And that's the mask. And that's why, you know, when you're with people, you can feel that place where they're not fully authentic. And I think that's true for all people. I don't know that anybody is fully authentic all the time. And in that place, that's what they're hiding. That's what they're protecting. And very often, as I said, they're hiding it and protecting it from themselves.
Why is that an effective survival strategy, to believe that there's something wrong with oneself?
Because it then will, it is the incentive to keep that part of you hidden, which you believe, if it's seen or expressed, will create disconnection. And a child cannot tolerate disconnection, right? And so we make it bad. We make it wrong. It actually makes sense, right? Yeah. Like, I'm going to make this part of me bad, and because mommy doesn't like it or daddy doesn't like it.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to keep it down because I want mommy and daddy to like me, to love me. And then that becomes a default operating system. And then we go out in the world believing that is true.
Yep.
And then we engage with people in relationships with that belief system. But it's all unconscious. People don't know that they're doing it. Hmm.
Is there any such thing as any type of seemingly maligned personality pattern, an anxiety, or a person that stonewalls, or a person that if maybe they're feeling depressed, or they disassociate, or they're psychopathic response, or, uh-huh. Or what, like all the different types of, they're avoidant, like all the different terms. All of those are rooted in actually benevolent survival strategies.
That's right.
And then what happens?
And then what happens in what, like, in what
at
sense?
At what point does that benevolent survival strategy become destructive in a person's life? And at what point, how do we start to manage and come into right relation with those patterns, or come into integration with those patterns?
I understand.
To be an integrated adult, and also be an acknowledgement and appreciation of, like, well, thank you, XYZ behavior
that's
now destructive in my relationship, for protecting me as a 6-year-old child.
Well, that's exactly it. First, you have to become aware of it. It's a pattern, and it has beliefs, and it operates in a particular kind of way, but it's like water to a fish. It's so ingrained. It's hard to become aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it manifests itself in like infinite fractals in our personality and situations.
Yeah.
So becoming aware of it is it's ego death after ego death. And it's painful to understand that. And also there's a part of us that doesn't want to know it, right? We don't want to know the game we're playing. So we hide from ourselves. So usually—
Why don't we want to know the game that we're playing?
Because that's the best way to play the game.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's just, because once I start knowing about it, then I have to take responsibility and then I have to change.
Right.
Right. And that, and I know intuitively that change is going to require facing myself, which is really facing my pain. And we don't want to do that, right? Because there's a belief that the pain is going to kill us.
Right.
And it's also, you know, do you want to obliterate your operating strategy that has gotten you this far in life, that has helped you survive? Like, we don't want to do that. So
we trust the survival strategy that we've held on to for the last 30 years over this person that we met 6 months ago.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, like, exactly.
I'm in such a deep relation with that strategy.
Of course. It's your best friend. It helps you survive. Yeah. Well, I'll share it because I wrote about this recently. So I'll use a story.
Yeah.
So when me and my lady fight, once we resolve it, she's ready to make up right away and cuddle and hug and kiss.
Oh,
and
she's like me.
Yeah, she's like
That's
you.
That's my thing.
I need a little time. I'm slow.
Okay.
So we had a fight and we're lying in bed, and I'm kind of a little bit still frozen. And she asks, can I come closer? And I'm like, not yet. And she's very accommodating. She knows me. She's very gracious. And it was, in fact, her generosity in that moment that I felt this twinge of shame. Mm. Like, what's my problem? You know, why am I doing this? Why can't I just get over it? And so I closed my eyes. And I really, like, I felt into my body, which is something that I've learned to do through all my somatic training. And immediately this image of a red dragon, like, standing over my heart, like, it came right into my mind. Mm. And I was like, oh, there's a red dragon protecting my heart. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, well, that makes sense. I had a lot of heartbreak as a child, and this dragon came on to protect my heart. And that's probably why I was essentially single for a lot of my life.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, so I have this dragon, but I also have this woman beside me that I trust, that loves me, and I know that. But the dragon doesn't know that, and the dragon doesn't trust. So I have to figure out how to talk this dragon out of this job that he's been doing all of his life, that he loves doing, that he's good at, that he's never failed at, and that he has tremendous pride in.
Yeah. Perfect batting record.
Exactly.
Yeah, you've never died.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so what am I going to do with that? How do I convince him that, you know, his job is done and he's no longer needed? And I thought, well, I'm going to have to give him another job. And I thought about that. I was like, well, geez, man, if I had the energy of that dragon, because that dragon is fucking a beast. If I channel that into creativity, if I channel that into building something, I could probably build and do whatever I want. Mm. And so I started talking to the dragon, like, you know, obviously in my mind. And I had the dialogue. And I could feel that part of me, you know, that was just, no, fuck that, fuck that. And I realized I had to, like, very, very gently persuade and had to understand and show appreciation for all the work the dragon had done. And the adult part of me had to come online and said, it's like you survived what happened to you. That is over now, right? Like, you're here. It's safe. And you can stand down and we can do something else with this energy.
Yeah.
And I think everybody has to go through some version of that. Now, it takes some time to get there, to come to that level of awareness, you know?
Yeah.
But yes, showing appreciation, acknowledgement for the defense, understanding how the defense works, and then making a conscious choice to do something different, knowing that the thing that you're going to do that's different is going to terrify you. Mm. And you have to choose to do it anyway. Mm. There's no way out of that. It's never, like, you have to take that leap into the unknown. Like, if you want to change, if you want to grow in any capacity at some point, you have to leap into the unknown and you have to risk death.
Yeah.
That's just what it is.
A person won't change typically unless they have to, I'd imagine, right?
I think that's right.
So it's usually probably the biggest pain that creates the biggest opening.
Yeah.
Is there any other way to change?
I don't think so. I don't, for me, I can only speak for me and most of my clients. You only change when you have leverage, and that leverage is usually massive pain.
Yeah.
You know, or you've been humiliated, or it's just so evident that there's something going on that you don't see in yourself. Yeah, like, you have a relationship pattern.
This isn't working.
Yeah, it's not
really
working.
Really, 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 really isn't working.
Yeah.
All of my outs. I have no more outs.
Yeah.
Jesus, take the wheel.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great spot.
It is a great spot because there's a kind of freedom there because you have no choice but to give it up. I remember we were talking before we started recording about my first marriage, which was, you know, a 4-month Hollywood marriage. And when I realized what I'd done, which was make a huge mistake that everybody on the outside could see, and I felt this deep sense of humiliation and shame about it, and I realized, like, oh wow, that was crazy. Like, what I did was crazy. I'm crazy. There's a part of me that's crazy. Some part of me took over, and I rationalized it, but I did it anyway, and it was scary that there were to really come to terms with there was some other part of me that I wasn't aware of that was, like, driving that was governing me, at least in this department. But on the other side of it, I actually felt a lot of relief because it was like I was no longer hiding. Like, it's like, okay, it's like I have this part of me that's out of control. And now it's everybody can see it. I can see it. And so now I can actually address it.
What were you seeking in the 4-month marriage with the Playboy Playmate situation or whatever you call it?
Yeah.
Celebrity thing.
I think I was seeking freedom. I think I was acting out being bad. I had been a good boy all my life. Through high school, through university, I was very well behaved and identified as a good boy. Like I did, I did stuff, but in general, I always tried to be good. I think the way that I was good for my mother, and in my whole acting career was essentially that I played like nice guys on TV. And I think there was some act of rebellion for me that I wanted to be bad. I wanted to give myself permission to not give a fuck. Mm. And so marrying a Playboy Playmate at the Tropicana Hotel in Vegas, it's kind of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And I think there was some part of me that just was trying to liberate myself from this identity that I felt trapped in.
You guys fight a lot, presumably?
We fought, yeah. We fought a lot.
All the time?
Not all the time, but...
Big swings?
Big swings without much resolution. Like, you know, this idea we came back to zero. Like, we fought, and then we resolved it, and it's clear, and we're moving on from it. That's the way it is in my relationship now, but no, we never came back to zero.
How does a couple genuinely get back to zero within conflict?
I think each person has to admit to themselves and to the other how they contributed to the conflict and what it was that they were protecting. Because it, really what's happening in a conflict, it's your defense versus their defense.
Yeah.
And so like you're not really...
Two monologues.
Yeah, you're not in reality at all, right? I mean, generally. And so it's their hurt child versus your hurt child. And so you have to be willing to take responsibility for what was actually going on, which is, you know, I was scared or I was hurt or I wanted to ask for something and I was too afraid to ask for it. I mean, people not expressing their needs is, I think, a source of a lot of conflict in relationship. And I think we have a lot of shame about our needs. We have a lot of shame about our pain. We have a lot of shame about our anger, some people.
Yeah.
And so when we have shame and we hide, we tend to act out. And when we act out, we on some level will provoke and that will ignite the conflict and then we're in something. I mean, unconsciously, I think most fights are the intention, like what are you fighting for? I think generally what couples are fighting for is connection. Mm-hmm. Like there's some lie in the relationship, right? Mm-hmm. There's something that's not being addressed. And it may not be conscious, but you can feel it. And it doesn't feel good to be out of connection.
Yeah.
And so usually when there is no consciousness around it, one or the other will provoke a fight in order to try to bring it into the light.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. And that's what happens in my relationships. And so I try to hold on to that awareness whenever either one of us provokes a fight. Like there's something else going on here. It's not about what it's about. There's something in the shadows and probably something very scary to look at. And something very vulnerable for both of us and something that doesn't feel safe to express.
Are there some things that are exclusively stored, like emotions, stories, traumas that are exclusively stored in the body and some that can be addressed with language and words and reorganization of the mind? Because it feels like sometimes it feels to me like it feels like this needs to be this pain, this resentment, this hurt, this whatever the thing is, it feels like we're not going to talk our way through to finding resolve.
Yeah.
With that. It's just going to keep on coming back, and, you know, it'll, the tension will come down enough to come back into what feels like balance.
Yeah.
But then that visceral component is still not addressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you do have to deal with the nervous system. If you're stuck in fight or flight, you're going to be activated, and then it's going to create a story in your mind, and then you're in that story, and then you're gone. Mm. So I do think it, you know, lives in the body, whether that's literal or figurative.
Yeah, what does that mean? Like the issues in the tissue, it lives in the body. Mm-hmm. Like this is a world where if you said this to Tate, for example, he'd probably, you know, balk at that and be like, okay, like, well, I don't actually know. Maybe he would actually agree with that, but it's entering into a little bit more of like the metaphysical type landscape.
Yeah.
And I think there's actually literal translations to that as well. It's just not as easy to put into exact, precise language.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you're bringing this up because Abigail Schreier just put out a new book. I forget what it's called, but it's a criticism of therapy, but mostly as it's geared towards children. Mm. And so she's been making the rounds and talking to different people about that. And I heard her really dismiss this idea that we hold trauma or feelings in the body, and that there's no science about it. I'm not so sure about that. I'm pretty persuaded by The Body Keeps the Score.
Sure.
I thought that was a pretty compelling book, and I'm persuaded by my own
experience
yeah. in the work that I do, because we use different physical techniques like hitting, punching, kicking, you know, tantrum, breath work, and different stress positions, like bioenergetic stress positions, to help people access feelings that are held in the body. Mm. And I don't think they could get to it any other way. And what happens when you move in that way, when you know you're hitting and screaming at your mother or your dad or whatever it is, and saying all the things that you were afraid to say, the movement takes you out of control, and it's the loss of control that different thoughts and beliefs come through, like what I actually feel comes through. Because the mind really likes to stay in control, which is why talk therapy, while useful, is not always effective. I really think you have to go through the body. And even if you are a talk therapist or you're practicing talk therapy, if you're not doing some physical practice in conjunction with it, I don't think you're going to get to a place of healing. I do think that it's in the body, and it makes sense. Like, if you are said no to over and over in an aggressive way as a child, well, what happens when somebody says no? You tense your body.
Yeah, sure.
And if you're always worried that your mom or your dad is going to scream at you, you're walking around tense. And that becomes default. And you're always tense.
Yeah.
Or maybe your needs weren't met. You were the sixth born child of two very overwhelmed parents, and you're walking around, you know, wanting attention, wanting to get picked up by mommy, and she just doesn't have time. Well, in that case, you would collapse, right? Like, you would collapse into your need, and you kind of assume a posture like a slouch, right? And you develop this idea like, my needs don't matter.
Yep.
And then maybe even compensate and say, well, you know, I don't need anything. I'm somebody who doesn't have needs.
Yeah.
And so you shape your body. Your body gets shaped in some way in response to the things that happened in your childhood. So it is, in that sense, trapped in our bodies. Our psychological defenses are mirrored in our physicality. And so it's one and the same. And so when I'm working with people, I go in through the body, essentially, to get to the unconscious mind.
Mm. I take a moment and share about one of the few supplements that I will actually bring with me while traveling, and that is magnesium, particularly from Mag Breakthrough. The reason that I really value Mag Breakthrough is they contain all 7 different forms of magnesium, as opposed to picking one specific one or taking one with a couple. There are 7 different forms, and Mag Breakthrough has all of them. I find them to be invaluable for sleep, for relaxation, for muscular recovery. It's supportive for digestion. Magnesium itself is supportive for 300 plus biochemical reactions in the body, and 75% of the population is deficient in this because we're just not getting it from our soil. I genuinely stand behind Mag Breakthrough. I've been a fan of them for years. I think you guys will get a ton of value from them. And if you want to get the 10% off on your purchase, you can go to buyoptimizers.com/align. That's buyoptimizers.com/align. You can use the promo code align10 for 10% off. I want to take a moment and share a free resource with y'all to sort out your movement. That is starting the first free week of the Align Method online program, where you get a thorough movement assessment to establish what is your personal movement baseline. And then on top of that, we share fundamental mobility techniques that will make a massive difference in your own personal practice if you do any type of stretching or yoga or foam rolling or resistance band training or training in general. You want to get the most out of your body. These are must-know mobility techniques. And then it finishes with a sit-rise challenge, so you can test yourself and see how effectively you get up and down off of the ground. That is the first week of the Align Method online program. It's a 6-week program. You can start the first week at alignpodcast.com/AMP. And with that, you will also join the free Align community, where there's over 3,000 other members in there. So I pop in there each day, totally free. The first week is totally free. And then if you don't love the idea of continuing on with the 6-week program, then you can cancel anytime. So check us out over at alignpodcast.com/AMP.
Mm. Yeah, there's the Jung quote. You already probably know the one I'm going to say. I'll probably missay, but until you make the unconscious conscious, it will govern your life, and you'll call it
direct
fate.
Your life, direct and we'll call life, it. Yeah, you'll call it fate. Yeah,
yeah. It seems like that's like something that's I've found to be very helpful if I'm disappointed in somebody or angry at somebody or whatever, is looking at that person as a child. You know, when you look at someone as like a 40-year-old man, you're like, mm-hmm. you're a piece of shit. Period. But mm-hmm. if suddenly you see a 4-year-old boy,
yeah,
this compassion opens up, and like, oh, you're out of control.
Yeah.
You feel afraid.
Yeah.
You feel insecure.
Yeah.
You don't feel lovable. You don't, if you have all these sensations of protection
mm-hmm.
because that boy feels unsafe ultimately.
That's right.
And then suddenly that can change like the texture of a conversation.
Yes.
Which is really powerful. And then probably the next thing to do with that would be to be able to mirror that back with yourself.
That's right.
And if you can hold that for yourself.
Harder to hold in yourself, because we tend to be very self-judgmental and self-critical.
Yeah. Why is it harder to hold in yourself? I mean, you just said, but like, say more about why it's harder to do that with yourself.
Because
why are we judgmental of ourselves?
It's a great question, because it gives us the excuse to avoid going after what we want or
right.
opening our heart. So if I believe that I'm unlovable, that's the perfect excuse for me to never have to open my heart.
Yeah.
So we don't want to give up that excuse. So being compassionate towards ourselves, we'd have to give up our game. And yeah. we don't want to give up the game because it feels too scary.
That's why I have a lot of respect for Tate's a very spiritual person. A lot of the stuff that he says feels very like, oh, that's like very Buddha-like, or that's very Bhagavad Gita-like, or that's very like, it's like a lot of the things. And one of the things that he talks about is the power of words. He talks about it, I'm saying pretty much like listening to that interview. I'm not like a devotee of Andrew Tate by any means.
Yeah.
I just find him very interesting.
Yeah.
But that was one of the things I thought was very interesting was he's kind of created this mind palace for himself. And a part of the structure of that palace is language. And within that, his language structure is, I do not allow any form of language that weakens me.
Yes.
And obviously, if you're in that place, there's also something that he said. I actually wrote down one of these. He said, I've tried very hard to have my mind rigidly analyzed. which rigidly I think is, it's interesting because he has a lot of rigidity in the way that he thinks and within the palace.
Yeah.
It does not change. It's not malleable. It's not fluid. I've established the palace. I know everything that I'll ever need to compete. That's something that, like, language that he uses a lot, as though life is a competition.
Mm-hmm.
Says a lot about his mm-hmm. perspective, you know, and identity structure and such. I've tried very hard to have my mind rigidly analyzed to make sure it's put together in a way that benefits me completely and absolutely. I do not believe in things that take power away from me. They are not real to me, and I live in my own mind. Which is actually beautiful and, like, sensible in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And there's, like, a shadow to that.
Well,
simultaneously,
the most for me,
and a potential plethora of potential blind spots that could exist within that, and it's also like, yeah, if it takes power away, what, like, let's, why not just, like, let go of that?
100 Yeah, I agree with that totally. You know, don't think thoughts or believe things that take away your power. I think
it's,
that's
not a thing.
That's,
and
great.
If I'm wrong, then well.
Yeah. Oh well. Exactly.
Whatever. I probably picked up a lot of momentum along the way.
Well, we're all in it. There's no way out of the delusion, right? It's like there's no way out unless you're going to go sit in a cave in Tibet.
Like, choose your delusion.
Yeah, choose your delusion and choose something that gets you results, right? But I live in my mind.
Yeah.
That you know, I didn't pick up on that in the interview, but it's like, yeah, you live in your mind. It's like, okay, well,
yeah,
you can't trust your mind.
I might have been misphrasing.
No, that's exactly what he said. But I remember.
It was something like that, yeah. Like, yeah, it's my mind, I live there, so
yeah.
I make my own rules.
Right.
And
yeah,
delusional or not, these are the rules.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at is this, there's a confession in that also. Live in my mind.
Yeah. And also the usage of the term rigidly.
Yeah.
I think there's more, there's other...
Yeah.
There's a lot of encryption within the language,
yeah,
that gets used in the,
yeah,
interview.
I think that, yeah, it's working for him. And I think there's things that we can learn from that. The case that I was trying to make to him was there's more.
There's more,
you,
yeah,
can be more powerful.
Yeah.
I believe.
And he opened up to that.
He did open up to that. In the place where you're in your mind, you're not present. That was the case I made.
You challenged him in a way that he could understand, which was competition. And there was, like, a potential place of, like, you could potentially have more power in being able to hold presence. And then why are you not powerful enough to hold presence?
Yes.
And that's when it hit, because it became like a masculine game.
Yeah.
I think. And it was like, oh, this is a rock to pick up.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Like,
yeah,
now suddenly I can see this is something. Is the,
yeah,
way that it felt to me.
No, I think that's absolutely right. You have to appeal to that side of people like that. I mean, I have to appeal to that side of myself.
Yeah.
Like, I had to give that dragon a really cool job to do, something that was going to bring us, you know, fame and riches or something good, you know,
yeah,
to appeal to that side of him. I mean, listen, I had a therapist I worked with for a long time who said the ego will always take a cut. Like, there's nothing pure, right? The ego's always going to be there standing by and looking to take its piece. And the best that we can do is just to keep an eye on it to make sure it doesn't take over and really start governing things.
Mm.
But you're not going to eliminate the ego. You know, it's always there, and it's just part of what it means to be human.
Mm. What are some other stuff that you've learned from Tate in observing him, studying, preparing, conversating?
Well, he's the real deal.
Yeah.
I mean, he practices what he preaches. I mean, he's an incredibly disciplined guy. I mean, you can see it in his body.
Yeah.
You know, he eats once a day. He works out hard. He's diligent with his work. He's loyal. He's friendly. He's very direct and clear. I mean, you know, I've been around a lot of powerful people, having been out in Hollywood and met movie stars, George Clooney, people like that, Leonardo DiCaprio. I've never encountered anyone like him. His aura, his charisma is just off the charts. Like, it's real. Like, he's one of the most impressive human beings I've ever been around.
Hmm.
And he's also extremely warm and generous. And that's the feeling that I got off him. He was just cool.
Yeah.
and open and humble in his way, at least with me. I mean, I'm, you know, 20 years older than him. I had the big gray beard. Whether he's conscious of it or not, I'm representing some kind of fatherly figure, wise man in that dynamic. So there was a kind of respect that he afforded me, which I appreciated, you know, and it made me respect him. But listen, I'm a big fan of his. I love what he's doing. I understand there's a lot that people can criticize, and he says a lot of crazy things. But that's the world we're living in. You know, if you want to get that level of fame, you got to say crazy things to get people's attention.
There was another thing that I liked in the mental model that he expressed in the interview was, said the flavor of life is pain. The sooner you get used to it, the more successful you will be. Which, again, that's a very
I agree with that
elucidating statement to just kind of the perspective on the world, which is also, again, it's very Buddhist. It's like there's a lot of spiritual texts that will have similar kind of, very reminiscent of that. But one of the things, like the models that I thought was interesting, if a person could adapt that truly, is along those lines of like, the more pain you give me, the more powerful I become.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very powerful perspective if you're able to actually hold that.
Yeah.
And based off of what he shares, it seems like he embodies that pretty well. I'm sure there's other levels to it, but based off it, just as what he shared in the interview, and it seems like the way he lives his life, I never met him, don't know anything about him. But to be able to hold that, that's a pretty major, would be a pretty major life hack. The harder you hit me, the stronger I get.
Yeah.
The more pain I feel, the stronger I get.
Mm-hmm.
Like, thank you, sir, may I have another.
Yeah.
To be able to actually embody that is a very, you almost become invincible.
That's true. I think he does embody that in a way. I mean,
I don't think he fully embodies that, but I'm just saying, based off of
the
language itself. Yeah, the principle itself, I'm saying, not relating it to like.
I mean, well, I don't know if you know Wes Watson. He's a guy who was in prison for 10 years and then came out and started making videos about prison life. And he's very funny and very eloquent and very powerful and very inspiring. And he blew up on YouTube, Instagram, and now he's this major influencer, but that's all he talks about. Mm. It's like, you got to go into your pain.
Yeah.
You got to be willing to face your pain. And I did that in prison. And he has a kind of Buddha-like wisdom that he got from the violence that he experienced and inflicted on others in prison.
Yeah.
And so I think there's really something to that, embracing our pain, not, you know, both emotional and physical pain. And if you can see it from that perspective, that this is going to make me stronger, and that it's not going to kill you. Mm. I mean, listen, most of our suffering, I think, comes from wanting to avoid our pain. Mm. It's there. So you have to face it. There's always going to be pain points in your life. And, you know, I'm just talking about in my relationship, like we went through some major pain points, both of us. And I didn't want to stay, and neither did she, like stay in that place where it was bringing up this much pain. But I knew that I wanted the relationship. I knew that she was a good woman and I trusted her. So I made a decision. I have to tolerate that. This is my pain. And the only way that I'm going to get into a relationship, I'm going to break up and get with another woman, and I'm going to have to go through the exact same thing.
Yeah.
So I might as well deal with it. And on the other side of that, I feel much freer than I did before. And our relationship is so much better, so much more free, so much more real and honest and light. And I'm sure there's going to be more pain points that will be revealed along the way. But the willingness to stay, stay present in our pain, I think is a superpower.
Do you think, I wonder, in a relationship, if two partners are willing to take full accountability for themselves and the way they show up, and they're willing to be committed and all in on the relationship, do you think there's anything that can't be healed in a relationship where it's just like that dyad just does not work? Full commitment, full accountability. Could you pretty much address anything?
I think so. I mean, It's hard to make a 100% definitive statement, but that sounds
sounds about right.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
What blocks partners from being able to find resonance or find ease or find integration?
It's just easier to blame you. Yeah. It's easier to blame the other person. If you just stop acting this way, everything would be fine. And sometimes you're right. Like sometimes you're absolutely right.
How do you parse that?
Well, you can be right about something and you still have to acknowledge that it brings up feelings inside you that are intolerable. And those intolerable feelings belong to you because she could have another man that wouldn't bother him at all. She could act in that way and he would just not even notice it.
Yeah.
So it doesn't really matter what she's doing. Your reaction to it is your reaction to it. And I would say that, and I've learned this, that nothing happens in a vacuum. So,
yeah.
And I picked up on, I mean, I've been doing this a long time, you know, working with people, leading groups. And so you develop a kind of sixth sense for things. You can just kind of feel when something's a little bit off. And so, yeah, when my lady was, you know, she'd do real subtle things. Just, you know, what you're talking about, leaving the dishes or something. And sometimes she was forgetting, but other times I'm like, she's fucking up to something.
Mm.
And I could feel it. And so I could be like, what the fuck is going on with you? Like, why are you doing this? I could make myself a victim, but maybe she's trying to communicate something to me. Maybe there's a place that I'm unconscious. Maybe there's a place that I'm not showing up.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something I'm contributing to it in some way. So, I mean, if you really want to go ninja in relationship, it's like when your partner is misbehaving, it's like you could actually look at yourself and how am I responsible for that?
Yeah.
Like, or what is my part in it?
Yeah.
And to look at yourself first and to any quote unquote bad behavior to look at it more as it's a communication. Yeah. They're communicating something.
Right.
And am I willing to hear it?
There's like language with words, body language, then action language.
Yeah.
Which is just an extension of, you know, the other languages.
It's all the same.
Your body language moves you into leaving the fucking dishes.
Yeah, well, the body language is probably the most accurate. You know, words, it's easy to lie with words. Rarely do we actually say what it is that we mean.
Can that become problematic? Well, I know the answer is yes. What if there's only one partner that's willing to show up in that way?
Why are you with a partner who's unwilling to show up in that way?
How do you?
That's the question you have to ask yourself. Like, that's a choice that you've made. And so that's a setup to say it's their fault. And that's a way that you get out of it.
Yeah.
That's the question I would ask somebody. Like, why are you in this situation?
Probably most folks, I would think, trend towards believing that they are the accountable ones.
Yeah.
And so parsing out where am I actually, in fact, in delusion with myself? Because it seems like I'm so damn accountable.
Yeah. Yeah, but I chose somebody who's not. It's like I keep dating people who are emotionally unavailable. Well, then you must be emotionally unavailable.
Yeah,
because if you're choosing these people.
Right. You know that they're not going to actually uncover those deeper parts within yourself that you're terrified to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you coach couples to higher levels of accountability and integrity within themselves and within the relationship?
Well, just that. Are they willing to take responsibility for themselves? Are they willing to acknowledge that every situation is a co-creation? Everything. Somebody cheats, that's a co-creation. I don't give a shit. It does not happen in a vacuum. Nothing happens in a vacuum.
Damn it, I cheated on myself again. Stop cheating on myself.
Exactly.
Which is not inaccurate, actually.
Well, you know, you break the law, you break yourself against the law. It's that concept, right?
Yeah.
So there's that level, but that's hard for people to get to, again, because the mind is so tricky. We don't want to take responsibility, because if we take responsibility, it leads us to feeling our pain. The other part of it is we're projecting a lot of our unconscious anger and resentment onto the other people, like our unmet needs.
Yep.
And so usually when couples are struggling, there's a lot of resentment. Mm-hmm. And where there's resentment, there's an intention to inflict pain,
yep,
to get payback, to punish. That is a very hard thing for people to come to terms with, that there is a part of me that has a negative intention with my partner. I want to hurt them. I want to say things that are cruel.
Could there be a place in certain traditions to actually have physically inflict pain as a part of the religion? Like, I'm thinking like Da Vinci Code, where the guy's like whipping mm-hmm. himself and making himself bleed and whatnot. You think there could be any benefit in that? I'm not suggesting anybody whips themselves until they bleed, but I wonder if that could address or satiate some deeper feeling of like wanting to inflict pain, or, you know, feelings of resentment or whatever it is, that you're not quite getting them out. Or is that just completely maligned that happens in certain traditions?
Well, that's the Lakota Sundance. They get pierced,
yeah, hang
right?
yourself up, yeah.
On the chest. It's they take a scalpel and cut through the chest, and I've done it, and it fucking hurts.
You do the Sundance?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Well, I owe four, so I'm 2 year into a 4 year commitment.
Wow. My buddy Parangi is the only person that I'm close friends with. I think he's done a handful of them now.
Yeah.
You know Parangi? Have you ever met him before?
I've never met
him.
He's
a musician.
Yeah, of course I know who he is. Yeah.
He's good. He's cool.
So it does exist. And I think I can only speak for me. It's incredibly valuable. I mean, it's an incredible technology that they devised, the Native Americans, and around suffering. Like, you're going to go out, whether it's the Vision Quest, whether it's Sweat Lodge, packed in a Sweat Lodge, you can't move, you can't really get out. And it gets to a point, it doesn't always get like this, but it can get to a point where it's excruciatingly hot.
Yeah.
And you have to deal with it. And there's a kind of suffering that you have to reconcile to. And it's the same with the Sundance. It's like you're suffering and you have to
come to terms with the suffering.
Yeah.
Come into relation with the suffering.
And
you can't push it away anymore. There's no way to push it away.
You can't disassociate. You have to face it, and you have to be with it. And really, there's only one place to go, and that's to God. And once you surrender to that, it's the best. And so what happens for me is, you know, the first year of Sundance, I was terrified, obviously. And I got through it. I was like, okay, I can do this. I can get through it. And the second year was a little bit easier. Now there's a part of me that's really looking forward to it. Even though I know I'm going to suffer, I know the benefit of that, the feeling that I get from that, the liberation, the connection with spirit, like to enter into the field of everything is one thing, and to really feel the power of God, like holy fuck.
Yeah.
I can't wait to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a total, you know, not how I was feeling about it the first time I did it. So I think, yeah, there is, I don't know if that's exactly what you're saying, but I think there's something in that we've lost in our culture. There's not these rituals that we have, and I think we're longing for them. And I think there is voluntary suffering, you know, with intention. To liberate ourselves from our pain. I mean, it's extremely, extremely valuable.
How does a modern person take themselves through or expose themselves to what would be like a traditional rite of passage, other than just allowing life to eventually kick your ass enough that it is a rite of passage? Or is that also fine?
I think you need community. That's my feeling, what I've come to. I was somebody who was very isolated for not all my life, but there was a period of time where I became extremely isolated, and it was damaging to my psyche. And I realized I had a problem, and like almost like an alcoholic would have a problem, and that I better do something about it. So I made a commitment that I was always going to live in community somehow, some way. I was going to find community and be a part of it, not just friends, like something like, you know, the way people would go to church or some kind of spiritual community. And I made that commitment, and that's changed everything for me. Communities are annoying, of course, because people are extremely annoying, and you have to put up with them, but there's your work, right? There's the opportunity. And So I think that would be the most important thing. And I think within often very much, you know, within communities, there are hopefully rituals, but I think those things are incredibly important. And I think that's why you see, you know, organizations like say Sacred Sons,
sure,
thriving, because they're recreating in some way these rituals that particularly men need.
Yeah. A couple questions, then we can wrap up because it's a beautiful day outside. What is, from your perspective, what do men need from therapy in contrast to what women need from therapy, or is it the same?
It's again, great question. So I think of therapy as you need the masculine and the feminine. And so, like, in some sense, mom and dad, because one of the ways to think about therapy is there's a kind of reparenting, mm-hmm, going on, and therapy really is effective because of the relationship.
Yeah.
So the feminine wants to provide nurturance and understanding.
Yeah.
Compassion. The masculine wants to provide challenge. And so I think men need both. Like, we do need the little boy to be seen, because we were vulnerable. We were a little boy. We weren't a man. And we need to be held and cry, like to feel like that's okay, to run into our mother's arms and be able to cry our tears away, yeah, or our father's arms and cry our tears away, and to be acknowledged in our fear. And it's like, it's okay to be afraid. Like, things are scary. But you also need challenge, you know, and that challenge has to be direct, and it has to put the person in a position where they feel uncomfortable. They may not like it, right? If my clients like me all the time, I'm not doing my job. And that's a real trick, right? Because you want your clients to like you, so they come back, you know, to complete the therapy. But if you're not pushing them in some way, challenging them, taking to the edge of the places where they're uncomfortable, where they're going to have to feel their discomfort, and they're not going to see you, they're not going to understand it, they're going to be mad at you, then you're not really doing your job. I mean, you know, you think about the father figure as a archetype. That's often what it is. Father's coming in with the medicine that maybe the children don't like, but is good for them. And, you know, dad is mean, dad's mean, da da da. I mean, that's the whole John Wayne archetype, right? It's you know, he was would come in and do the thing that nobody else would do. And it was very uncomfortable for people to witness, but he did it anyway. A man's got to do what a man's got to do. So he's not going to be seen, understood, maybe not appreciated, but he's got to do it anyway. So I think when you're, you know, for a man in therapy, you want to have a therapist that's going to challenge you. And I think that's why a lot of guys don't want to go to therapy, because most therapists are women. And it's not to say that women can't do that, but it's a different vibe. It's a different vibe when it's coming from a man. When a challenge is coming from a man, it's so I understand, you know, but if you can find a good male therapist out there, and you know, who knows what he's doing, therapy can be incredibly valuable.
What do you think is happening with the breaking down between the meaning of masculine, feminine, male, female? Why is that happening?
I mean, I evil. It's evil. That's how I see it. I mean, it's masculine and feminine it's nature, right? So you're attacking the heart of God. That's what I see. There's this speculation that there's a pattern that the end of empires always lead to a kind of androgyny.
Yeah, right. You've
probably heard that.
Yeah, I've heard that.
So it looks like that's being expressed through the all the transgender, the
it's
non-binary.
Like the breaking down of all structure.
Yeah, yeah.
The walls are falling.
Yeah, the walls are falling, and there's no power.
Nothing
in that.
Is real.
Nothing is real.
You can't grab at anything.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, now it's time to dissolve.
Exactly. A man can be a woman. A woman can be a man. A man can give birth. A woman can have a penis. I mean, it's obviously absurd, right? But we're having these conversations. We're arguing about it, which is a sign that they're winning. Mm. And I think it comes from like some deep subversive place inside people, that are, you know, angry and resentful and have an intense desire to inflict onto others what was done to them. So I can hold them in my heart, you know, understanding that they've probably been traumatized and brainwashed. Nevertheless, I think, you know, what's going on is like really fucking harmful. But I guess this is what we have to go through. And I guess the positive side is it's forcing us to really become more disciplined. And I don't know, for me, I mean, I heard Rogan say it the other day. It's like, Jesus Christ is the only thing that can save us. And to hear him say that was really interesting, because that's what it's been for me over the last 3 or 4 years. I've always had a relationship with God, but as things feel like they're getting more and more insane, into chaos, it's like, if you don't go to God, there's nothing else to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm grateful for that, you know, because my relationship with God, with Spirit, with Creator, is like become a lot stronger, and that's been a source of a lot of peace and power in my life.
Who are the? And then we really will wrap up. Who are the? As had a conversation with Teal Swan like two and a half weeks ago or so, and so we talked about this exact thing. And she has very specific names for the reptile people that they are, and the planets, and you know that all of the.
You mean the alien? Like
the aliens? Yeah, uh-huh. all the things. Who is the evil from your perspective, or what is the evil from your perspective?
Well, that's a great question. I can only talk about it through my framework, which is, you know, we call it the lower self, right? It's the part of us that got really, really hurt, and we separated from ourselves. Mm. And we made a decision that we were never going to be vulnerable again. We were never going to open our hearts. Mm. We were never going to be here all the way. We're never going to exist, right? Yeah. This powerful no to life. No, it's really no to ourself.
Yeah, I'll never let myself get hurt again.
I'll never let myself get hurt again. And there, it's I'll never or I won't. Like, very powerful. And there's a lot of energy. That's the dragon energy, right? That's just going to protect the heart at all costs. And if that energy is not being used towards, you know, creation and love, it's going to be used towards destruction. And so that exists in all of us. I mean, there's an evil force that's inside me, and I've acted out on it in different ways, not in overt ways, but certainly in subtle ways in my relationships. And, you know, I've been cruel and selfish. And ultimately, it hurts me more than anyone. So I think what happens is people, they're in the grips of it, and they don't feel like there's any other place to go. And it's the only power and control that they have. And then they get with other groups of people who all share these feelings of resentment and anger, and they create an enemy inside their mind, and then they set about exacting their revenge. And that's a human trait. It's a pattern that's repeated throughout history. We are in the middle of it, and it's scary. I mean, that energy is very, very scary, because it's irrational, it's chaotic, it's not present, and it refuses to negotiate, and it's intent on destruction. Mm. So for me, that is evil. But I also that lives inside me.
Yeah,
like I know that energy in me, you know.
It's also probably coming to a place of having compassion for the evil and seeing it as a part, you know, like destruction is a part of creation. And that's not to say like, cool, let's just destroy it all. Or maybe it is, or maybe it isn't. But it's like I wonder if there's some path towards having compassion for that, what we're kind of villainizing and demonizing as the destructive part.
Yeah, I think you have to hold.
Because then suddenly we're in the holy position. And we're kind of casting, you know, the shadow. And now it's like, holy, perhaps I'm the progenitor of the shadow.
We could be doing the exact same thing, right? Yeah. Like making them the enemy and rationalizing, being able to annihilate them.
Yeah.
There's a great book by Howard Bloom called The Lucifer Principle, in which he tries to make the evolutionary case for evil. Like, if evil exists, and he gives his own definition of evil, which I think most people would agree that it does. Why is it here?
Mm-hmm.
And he makes the case that it's an evolutionary force, like that it's necessary, it's needed. And he tracks history and shows how these patterns repeat, and an evil force comes up and it causes the good to rise up. And a battle is waged and there's something different and new on the other side of it. So, you know, can we hold it all? I'm having a human experience. I'm here. I'm on the earth. I'm going to engage in life as much as I can. And can I simultaneously understand that I'm actually an avatar and none of this is really real? Yeah. And can I hold it all, that good and evil is it's one thing. They need each other, that the light and the dark are they're not separate. Yeah. And they're not separate outside of me. And so, but while I'm here in this human experience, it's I am separate on some level. And that's okay. Like to be in that human experience with the awareness. To me, that's the game. To know I'm in the video game, but also I'm not identified with the character.
Yeah. There's a Ram Dass quote, again, paraphrasing. I think something along the lines of, the best thing that you can do for me is work on yourself, and the best thing I can do for you is work on myself. And as you're talking, I'm wondering, like, well, at an individual level, if you care about whatever, justice, or, you know, being a courageous citizen and being like a part of some kind of push for good, like, what does a person do at an individual level? Because a lot of those conversations of aliens and reptiles and deep, you know, unconscious evils circulating everywhere, including inside, like what do I do with that?
Yeah, what do you
you know?
Yeah, what do you do with it? I don't know. Me and my lady, because we can get lost down these rabbit holes, because she's, you know, she'll go there. And yeah, we,
it's a really privileged position to get lost in. Like, when you actually sometimes I'll have conversations that are edging around pedantic, not that this is one of those,
but
like oftentimes I'll be sitting like, I'm so into this conversation, but this is kind of bullshit.
Well, because ultimately, you know, you don't know. Somebody's
build,
like,
a house, or, like, you know,
exactly,
help somebody, like, feed somebody, or like, there's, I could be doing things right now.
Yeah, and my like my neighbor, who's it's an old Mexican couple. They're probably in their 70s, and he still paints houses. He looks like the most happy, pleasant man I've ever seen, and I'm sure he's not talking about any of this shit. He's just going about his life.
No.
And so I think about exactly what you said. I think about that a lot. Like, yeah, these conversations are privileged, and you know, they're fun to have sometimes, to speculate.
It's like a muscle.
Yeah, but ultimately I'm it's like, I don't know. Are there aliens here? Are they walking among us? Am I an alien? How the fuck am I gonna know? I can't know that.
I don't know.
So all I have is what's here in front of me, and I know what makes me happy, and I know it feels good, and I know it doesn't feel good, so I'll just let that be my guide.
Yeah. I really enjoyed this, man. Thank you so much for making time to do this. If people want to go deeper into your stuff, which I'd highly recommend them spending more time with you in whatever capacity, what's like the best place or direction?
Well, you can, davidsutcliffe.com is my website, and it's all there. I'm pretty active on Instagram, davidsutcliffe33. Sign up for my newsletter. I'm writing a lot now. That's kind of become my focus, is my newsletter. So that's been really, really good. So I'd love it if people would sign up for my newsletter.
Finding writing to be great. I don't do it enough, but it's like the crystallization of your thoughts. You know, your thoughts are these nebulous, airy things floating around, and sometimes you feel good about your thoughts, and sometimes you're like, I don't even know what the hell I'm saying right now. Writing, it kind of coagulates all that into a thing, and you're like, oh, this is my thought.
That's exactly why I'm doing it.
That's
because
nice.
I'm at an age where it's that time to really, like, consolidate my knowledge into a package and transfer it to people. It feels good. I'm really enjoying it. And sign up for my newsletter.
Have you ever done a book? You're going to do a book?
I'm going to do a book. I didn't think I was going to do a book because writing was always so hard for me. But now that I've been writing consistently and getting into it and picked up my speed of it, then I'm like, I could actually write a book. But I didn't think 6 months ago that I could. But I there's definitely a book in me.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Well, I appreciate you.
Appreciate you.
Thank you all for tuning in. That's it. That's all. I'll see you next week. Bye.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. Jump over to the Align Podcast YouTube page labeled Aptly Align podcast. Subscriber there if you're interested in seeing the video version of this, being able to comment and be a little bit more intrinsically involved in the conversation. I love reading the comments. I love commenting back and just seeing what you guys think of different clips and different parts of the episode. Thanks for subscribing here. Thanks for reviews. Thanks for doing you. I will see you next week.